Some laws affect all of us. We all have to wear seatbelts in cars or face getting a ticket, for example. Some laws affect far smaller populations. Oregon's Death with Dignity law is an example. Terminally ill people can get prescriptions for medication to end their lives. Since its use is not so widespread, the law can stay off the radar for a while. Brittany Maynard recently put it back there. She was 29 years old and a recent transplant from California, specifically because she wanted to come to Oregon to use the law. She was going to die of brain cancer otherwise. This gives us a chance to catch up with the law as it stands in Oregon and the two other states that have adopted it since, Washington and Vermont. Peg Sandine is our guest. She's the executive director of the Death with Dignity National Center. She earned her Ph.D. in social work and social research from Portland State University and her master's in social work from the University of Iowa. Peg Sandine is an experienced direct practice social worker specializing in issues related to terminal illness and end-of-life processes. Peg Sandine, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
And death with dignity is the terminology that you and I'm sure everybody else with the movement seems to prefer. I noticed the term suicide generally is not used as part of this.
Correct. And, you know, one of the reasons why I don't use the term personally is out of respect for people who hasten their death using Oregon's law, because to a person, they all want to live. They don't want to die. They don't want to commit suicide. They want to live, but they have an illness that is killing them. So out of respect for them, I definitely do not use the word suicide.
All right. There is an important distinction there that you bring up well, that it is a different kind of set of circumstances. We're not talking about people who want to die.
No, we're not talking about people who are depressed or have mental health concerns. We're talking about people who are going to die because they have cancer or another illness.
As Brittany Maynard's case came to the fore, was this something that, it appears to have brought new attention to the Death with Dignity law?
Oh, it certainly has. You know, she was just a different type of person than America thinks about when they think about people who are dying. And I think that she had a compelling and tragic story, and you know, America just had such compassion for her story that I think that it really resonated with folks.
Is it attention that is, I have to assume that you might have gotten a few more contacts at the Death with Dignity National Center, and is it welcome attention?
Oh, absolutely. It, you know, one of the interesting things about our issue is that when you ask sort of everyday Americans how they feel about the law, about 60% of them support it. But whether or not it's an important issue or an issue that they think about very often, you know, that is not the case. And so you have something that is really has high support, and then you add this compelling face to it, and suddenly it emerges everywhere.
This is so different from so many other issues, though, because it's not like when you have gotten to the point where you've gotten what you want passed into law and the law has been upheld by courts and all the things that have happened with the Death with Dignity law. It's not like there's great celebration, because it just isn't like that. It's just not that kind of issue.
Right. It is not like that. And I think also culture works against the law in a bit. And what I mean by that is, we have this culture of life. We are there's a death taboo, right? And we think about our youth and we think about our health, and we really don't like to think that death is going to happen to us. And so we have this law which allows us to control the timing and manner of our death in Oregon and Washington and Vermont, but we really don't want to think about it, right? And so I think that that's another reason why it's sort of hidden or quiet, just because our culture has this death taboo.
And what do we have numbers, reliable numbers, on how many people have used the Death with Dignity law in Oregon thus far?
Yes. About 1,100 or 1,200 people have had prescriptions written. So the law was passed first in 1994, and it went into effect in 1997. And, you know, about 800 people have died. So it's very rarely used
and,
in Oregon.
And of the people who have used it, do we have any demographic info on the general set of circumstances, age, gender, and disease?
Yeah, you know, it's split about 50-50, men and women, and it's mostly used by people who are older. So the average age is about 75, 71, somewhere in that area. And about 80% of people had cancer. So, over all time, that cancer is really the number one reason why people would end up using the law.
And there are certainly some fairly tight confines on what constitutes terminal illness and the time between prescription and presumed death, right?
Right. So according to the law, a person is only eligible to qualify for a prescription if two physicians say that they have a terminal illness that will lead to their death within 6 months. So both physicians have to say that.
Now, when we're talking about the average age of the people using the Death with Dignity law in Oregon being 75, I mean, this makes Brittany Maynard a major outlier.
Right. Absolutely. A very big outlier because she was young when she died, right? That's a very young age for someone to die in general.
Was she unique in moving to Oregon to be able to use the law?
You know, it's rare, but it does happen. And if you just think about those times in your life that you have moved and what a hassle it is, finding an apartment and putting all your stuff in storage and moving and all of those things that you have to think about doing, how difficult it is. And then if you have a terminal illness on top of it, it just seems almost impossible to accomplish. And so it does happen. People do want to control the timing and manner of their death. And so they do occasionally move to Oregon, but it is incredibly burdensome.
Does the law itself specify a period of residency before the act can be used?
You know, the law itself just refers to whatever the state's requirements for residency are. So the Death with Dignity Act does not set up requirements for residency. The state of Oregon has requirements for residency.
And what, 6 months or even less than
there's
that?
There's not a time frame associated. There's a series of things to accomplish, like filing taxes or having a driver's license or owning or renting property. So those things take time to accomplish, but there's not a time frame set up in Oregon law to establish yourself as a resident.
Okay, here again, a chance for us to ask a lot of questions about Oregon's Death with Dignity law and Death with Dignity on the books in Washington and Vermont as well now with Peg Sandine, the Executive Director of the Death with Dignity National Center. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and take your phone calls and emails when we return in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Peg Sandine, the Executive Director of the Death with Dignity National Center. So we're talking about Death with Dignity laws in Oregon, now in Washington, and in Vermont as well. Oregon's law obviously got a little more news of late when 29-year-old Brittany Maynard moved to Oregon from California to use the law rather than die of brain cancer. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the many, many issues contained within Death with Dignity. Join us at 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, same number, 800-838-3760. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. Peg, I'm a little curious about your own background because we mentioned that you specialized or have specialized in a long time in issues related to terminal illness and end-of-life processes. So was it a gradual embracing of the Death with Dignity idea that led you to where you are today?
You know, it wasn't a gradual embracing. Like many people who are advocates in this movement, I came to it because of a personal experience. And so when I was about 27 years old and my husband was 33, he was diagnosed with a terminal illness and he died. And so it was a very, an experience. We were very young. We were both very young. He was very young when he died. And he wanted to control the timing and manner of his death, and he was unable to because of the laws prevented it. And so I came to understand at a very young age how important this law was.
And it has, so now we're talking 20 years since the law originally passed. That's another
right.
reason for talking to you today. It's been 20 election years, or 20 years since the election of November 1994 that put Death with Dignity on the books. As you pointed out, though, it did not take effect until 1997, so there was a bit of a holdup on the front end. What was that?
There was an injunction, a court injunction, that prevented implementation of the law. So when the law went into effect, the Oregon voters passed it in 1994. That was November 8th, just like you said, 1994. So that was 20 years ago. And there was an immediate injunction against implementation, so it could not go into effect. And that injunction was lifted in 1997, right before the election in 97. And it went into effect right around November 97.
And there was a second vote on the law. Was it before the injunction was lifted or just after?
It's interesting. It's sort of a little-known piece of trivia that policy wonks are interested in, that the judge lifted the injunction, I think, 2 days before the election. But the pro Death with Dignity campaign didn't want that known, because they didn't want that to impact the outcome of the election at all. So it was sort of hidden, but it did go into effect a couple days before the 97 election.
And I want to talk about some of the legal challenges down the road. I want to talk about within the law itself, though, the steps and the processes, because if people are not familiar with the law, they might not realize how intricate it can actually be to be able to end your life with the medication. So can you walk us through the steps?
You bet. So about half of the law, the language of the law, is a section called safeguards. And what those safeguards do is protect vulnerable individuals protect individuals from coercion. And so in trying to protect individuals, there are a series of burdensome steps that a person with a terminal illness has to pass through to qualify for the medication. And so the law is written with the sort of tension between protecting vulnerable individuals and allowing individuals a right to death with dignity. And so the steps that someone would have to go through include, I mentioned earlier, two physicians have to confirm diagnosis, prognosis, and also that they have to confirm that the person is mentally competent to make healthcare decisions. A person who wants to access Death with Dignity has to go through three requests. So they have to do two oral requests to their physician and one written request to their physician. That written request has to be witnessed so that people can say that, you know, they're not being coerced into it. And also there's two waiting periods that a person has to go through. So there's a whole series of steps that someone has to pass through to be qualified to get a prescription.
Peg Sandin, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the executive director of the Death with Dignity National Center based in Portland. So two doctors, finding of mentally competent to make healthcare decisions, three requests, one of them written. Doctors, can they opt out of this themselves if they just don't feel comfortable with it?
Absolutely. Doctors, healthcare systems, pharmacists, patients can opt out at any time. If someone goes through the process and they decide they don't want to take the medication, they can opt out. So really, Death with Dignity is about choice for every step of the way and every person involved.
Lots of reflection time. What seems to be the minimum amount of time that can pass between the original request to doctor and the actual delivery of prescription?
About 17 days mm-hmm. is the minimum amount of time that can progress.
Have there been any changes in procedures since the original law passed in 1994?
There haven't. It's so interesting that one of the things that is truly remarkable about the Oregon Death with Dignity Act is that it was model legislation for the entire world when it was written in 19, you know, and proposed to the voters in 93, 94. And the folks who wrote it got it right. They got it right the first time. And it is so rare that we see legislation that is right the first time. But there have not been changes in implementation since the law was passed.
Lest anybody think that the people who are behind this were people who embraced a culture of death or anything like that. Dr. Peter Goodwin was the father-in-law of a close friend of mine, and
right.
And was a riot. Was a really funny guy, and all about life.
Right. I have such admiration, and I have learned so much from Peter in my time that I knew him.
There are some questions here then, given the length of time. I mean, granted, nobody, you know, 17 days doesn't sound terribly long, but for somebody who's approaching the end of life and not comfortable, That can be an agonizing amount of time. And the numbers you gave earlier, 1,100 prescriptions, essentially since the birth of the law or the implementation of the law, and about 800 people using it. So 300 people either never got the medication or never got to use it or just never followed through the process. But this implies that perhaps some people did, in fact, maybe die in pain.
Well, I think that what it implies is that a third of the people who qualified did not choose to take the medication to hasten their death. That 1,100, they all made it through the process, and they chose not to take the medication. And so what the medication did for them was give them peace of mind. They knew if the suffering was great tomorrow, they could hasten their death. But if they could tolerate their symptoms, if life was still good and their quality of life was good, they could live another day.
Have there been any bumps in implementation or lessons learned along the way? I mean, you mentioned that they got it right the first time, so no tweaks to the law itself. But anything in the processes implemented under the law that have been refined at all?
I think that if you think about changing behavior, how law changes behavior, and does law change behavior? One of the things that had to change early on is that physicians had to be comfortable with this idea, and they had to understand that they were protected under Oregon's law. And so early on, I assume that there was access issues, that there may have been some people who are interested in using the law, but they could struggle to find a physician in a rural area, for example. And certainly in Washington, when they passed their law, the Washington group there worked very hard to identify physicians all over the state. And similarly in Vermont, that process is still ongoing. So getting the medical community to adopt death with dignity as a policy and as a practice takes time. Just passing Oregon's law didn't change physician behavior overnight. And so I think that that's probably the implementation arc that happened, that it was became more and more accessible, especially in rural areas over time.
The topic on the Jefferson Exchange is Choose Your Term, Death with Dignity, or Oregon's Assisted Suicide Law, also as it relates to the new laws in Washington or recent laws in Washington and Vermont. Peg Sandin is the Executive Director of the Death with Dignity National Center in Portland. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Bruce in Ashland sends an email. He says, my mom passed Friday. Without her directive, it would have been really hard. But the directive really has no power unless the medical system respects it. They did, and I am grateful. I have known many people who have killed themselves near the end. A typical way is to stop eating and drinking. Other ways are hard for those left behind to deal with. Anybody struggling to live, suffering, should have the right to go. We as a society need to allow ourselves a way to comfortably and consciously leave our bodies when they no longer serve us. Why prolong the suffering and the inevitable? That from Bruce in Ashland. Thoughts, Peg?
I think that everyone should have an advanced directive or a living will to help their loved ones make decisions at the end of their life if they're not able to make decisions. That's different from death with dignity because you can't spell out in an advance directive that you want death with dignity, but certainly that having your wishes spelled out in writing so that your physician can honor them and they help your loved ones make decisions is incredibly important.
This is very narrowly confined when you think about it, though. I mean, we're talking about the way that the death with dignity laws are written. It has to be a terminal diagnosis, not just my quality of life has declined to the point where there just is none left, essentially.
Right. And really, a very, very small number of individuals qualify every year, and it is because that process is so narrow. And again, I'll take us back to that conversation I had earlier. The state of Oregon has an obligation to protect vulnerable individuals against coercion. And so the law strikes this tension of protecting vulnerable individuals and creating a right for a small number of individuals. And that's why the process is burdensome and difficult.
I lived in Oregon myself during both of those votes on the on what became the Death with Dignity law. And coercion was the major reason that people seemed to give for voting no on it, that they were just afraid that this is going to be it's time for grandma to get out of the way kind of thing. But from what I have seen over nearly, 17 years now of implementation, I don't see any evidence of that.
Right. There's no evidence that that has happened. even once in Oregon. So while that argument may have been a reasonable argument when this was a brand new policy for the entire world, it is certainly not a reasonable argument anymore because the Oregon statistics demonstrate that it doesn't happen.
All right, we have another email here from John in Ashland. He writes, "While I'm a big supporter of a person's right to make their own medical decisions, including ending their life, Brittany Maynard's suicide was heavily influenced by her poor research and nihilistic approach. No brain tumor is inherently terminal when diagnosed, even those whose death rate is 95%. Brain tumor treatments in particular have seen a huge paradigm shift towards highly effective, low-toxicity approaches such as immunotherapies, oncoviruses, and even computer-controlled low-voltage electrical currents as we see in the FDA-approved NovoCure treatment. And being young and otherwise healthy, this woman likely had many years at least of healthy, productive life ahead of her, while every year more advances are made. My friend Cheryl in Klamath Falls was given the same diagnosis 14 years ago and continues to climb mountains quite literally. Those on the front lines of medicine hold great power over their patients and must avoid falling into the trap of nihilism when dealing with serious disease, especially cancer, for which treatments are undergoing dramatic paradigm shifts." John writes, "I didn't walk in Brittany's shoes, but in interview after interview, video after video, her ignorance of her own disease was astounding, almost medieval." That again from John in Ashland. Have you gotten other contacts from people who were not particularly happy about the attention that Brittany Maynard was bringing to Death with Dignity, Peg?
We did get a few. I would say that overwhelmingly, the support and compassion and love that we received and were asked to pass on to Brittany Maynard was really the biggest point of contact for us. We did receive a few suggestions that she try diet or she try a different treatments and maybe move to a different state for a different treatment, but those were really sort of rare, and it seemed odd to me. The folks weren't physicians, they didn't know her, and so suggesting that she tried some type of other treatment or medical treatment just seemed unsupportive in a strange way.
And again, Peg Sandina, our guest in the exchange, the executive director of the Death with Dignity National Center. So just to clear up, though, to make sure we're quite clear with Brittany Maynard's story particularly, the two doctors need to be doctors based in Oregon, right?
Yes, they do. They did.
All right. And it has to be death within 6 months. Is this the extent of the terminal prognosis?
Right. Right. And so in her case, two separate physicians, both had to examine her and review her charts and her tests and determine that the glioblastoma, the brain cancer that she had, was terminal and it would lead to her death in 6 months. So both physicians determined that.
All right. So we're not talking about necessarily much beyond the 6 months. Anyway, that's the way the doctors looked at it. We've talked about the two votes. I did mention that I wanted to get into some of the legal history here because there were certainly court challenges as well, including the original injunction that delayed implementation of the Death with Dignity Act for just about 3 years. What in fact was the court history? Because I was looking at some of the case history in particular with John Ashcroft. This went on for quite a while.
Oh yeah, the Ashcroft case went on for a very long time. And what John Ashcroft did was he said that he was going to use the power of the Department of Justice, the federal Department of Justice, to prosecute Oregon pharmacists and physicians who were practicing under Oregon's Death with Dignity law. And our organization stepped up to represent those physicians and pharmacists and to say, no, you can't do that, right? You cannot prosecute what is lawful in Oregon. And that case wound its way all the way up to the Supreme Court. And it was the Chief Justice Roberts, his first major case, and we had a 6-3 victory in that case. It was a solid sort of setback for Ashcroft and Alberto Gonzalez, who was the successor to Ashcroft.
Were there any particular surprises in the outcome of the case? I mean, given the conservative nature of the court and the culture of life that the conservative end seems to propagate, I mean, was it a surprise that you ended up with such a clear decision?
No, we were pretty confident that we were going to have a clear decision. One of the reasons why is just like the Oregon Death with Dignity Act was very narrow. This court decision was very narrow, and what it said is that the Justice Department did not have the authority to prosecute Oregon pharmacists and physicians. And in our country, historically, the practice of medicine has been left to the states. And so we were pretty confident that the court could not find a way to change that historic way that medicine is guided by the states.
And speaking of states, there are now two others that have death with dignity laws on the books, Washington and Vermont. Different processes. I want to talk about Washington's first. Did Washington essentially take the Oregon template and just change the word Oregon to Washington?
Yes. The Washington law is nearly a mirror image of the Oregon law. It is nearly exactly the same.
And passed by voter initiative, just as it was in Oregon. We'll come back and talk more with Peg Sandin. We have some phone calls waiting as well. Peg is the executive director of the Death with Dignity National Center, and we're talking about Oregon's Death with Dignity law. In colloquial language, usually referred to as Oregon's assisted suicide law, it allows terminal patients to end their lives before their actual condition kills them. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about this, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Peg Sandin and your phone calls and emails when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Peg Sandin, the executive director of the Death with Dignity National Center. So clearly we are talking about death with dignity laws on the books in Oregon, now Washington and Vermont as well. Brittany Maynard's case at the age of 29 moved to Oregon from California so she could use the law to make sure that she died before terminal cancer really took away her quality of life. And again, the death with dignity law, assisted suicide, whatever you want to call it, does require a diagnosis of something that will kill you within 6 months. Join us on the exchange as we talk about the law and its use. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about Washington. When did Washington vote its death with dignity law into effect?
2008, election night on 2008.
Okay, big night on a lot of fronts in America.
It was a big night.
And so now, again, Washington and Oregon both by initiative petition, so the voters essentially put this on the ballot. In Vermont, a very different process and a curious one.
Right. So 10 years ago, a group of volunteers in Vermont reached out to our organization and said, will you help us pass a law, but we don't have the ballot initiative process. And so we worked with them for about 10 years to get a law through the legislature. And I think that it was introduced four different times in the legislature, and it was a difficult legislative process, but finally championed by Peter Shumlin, who is the governor of Vermont, and the law was passed just last year in 2013.
Did the process start when Howard Dean, himself a physician, was still governor?
Oh, man, I am not sure about that.
Sorry, I wasn't meant to be stump the executive director, Tom.
Yeah, that was stump the executive director.
I was just curious because, again, him being a physician and all, but Vermont seen as one of the more liberal states in the country, but again, no initiative process, so it had to happen legislatively. Has it taken effect in Vermont yet?
Yes, it has taken an effect. It went into effect immediately, so it was, I believe, May or June of 2013.
And any particular differences from the Oregon template?
You know, it was a legislative process. They did start with the Oregon law. I would sort of say that what it is it's the Oregon law written in an all different order. So all of the same pieces and steps are enshrined in Vermont law. They're just constructed differently.
Given the history, I mean, we're talking 20 years now since Oregon passed its law. Granted, it didn't take effect for 3 years because of injunction, but the country has 20 years of history now dealing with, or being aware anyway, of death with dignity legislation in place. I'm curious that there are just three states, though. I mean, is it surprise you that this long after Oregon's passage, we're still talking about only three places in the country that do allow assisted suicide / death with dignity?
Well, I'm not surprised. If you think of the sort of the history of social movements in our country, our movement is only about 20 years old. So if you compare that to 45 years for marriage equality or much longer for civil rights, our movement is very young. And so I think that that's one issue. And also, if you think about the series of court challenge that our issue faced, those court decisions were finally decided in 2006. The Oregon v. Gonzalez case was decided in 2006. And then we had the second state step up right in 2008. And so I think that we are going to see more states move to death with dignity policies, but that court challenge really stopped the states from adopting a law.
And if you had to make a guess, I mean, California is certainly similar to Oregon and Washington politically. Are you surprised that California hasn't gone to this step yet?
I'm not surprised that California has not moved forward with death with dignity yet. If you look at the rate of how California adopts new policies, it's rarely the first state. It is frequently, you know, the sixth or seventh state. So it's an important state. It's kind of a bellwether state, but it's certainly rarely the first.
As it is with many things, I mean, once California does adopt something, although this tends to be more in economic sorts of realms because it is such a big economy, that other states do follow. I mean, is your thinking along the lines that if California should adopt death with dignity, other states might follow?
Oh, definitely. And I also think, you know, if we think New England, Massachusetts is the other big state that would be important for the U.S. So certainly both California and Massachusetts are important states for our movement.
Let us take a call. We have Bill in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Peg Sandeen from the Death with Dignity National Center.
Yeah, good morning, Jeff. I very much favor the law, of course. I voted for it twice. I reject the suggestion by some of the religious folks that I don't have a right to take my life. I do have a right to take my life. I don't plan to do so. I don't have the courage to do so, but I think I have that right. But I do have the right to take my life without that law. If I want to take my life, I can do so, and I don't even have to go through that law if I don't want to. So that's a thought that has not been expressed here today, but I'd like to hear the nice lady's comment about that.
All right. Appreciate the call, Bill. Peg, your thoughts?
I think that, I'm a social worker, and that's my background. And I think that taking one's life or suicide, a traditional sort of suicide, is a violent act, and it's an act that can be very harmful for a family and very hard for a family to overcome. And so I think that while we don't ban it, right, that the act of suicide, I think that there are much better alternatives, and I really prefer for people to pursue life.
The term I noticed that been used a lot in recent years, the physician aid in dying, PAID. And here again, though, it's not this is not like Jack Kevorkian, and that was one of the things that I think people misunderstood when Oregon's law first passed. The person who has requested the prescription has to administer the dose themselves. Somebody else can mix it for them, correct? But they have to drink it themselves?
Right, absolutely. They have to ingest it themselves.
All right. So big difference there. We have an email here from Shoshana in Ashland. Do you foresee a time when those with excruciating and at this time uncurable mental health diseases might also have the option of death with dignity rather than suicide, which sometimes does become the choice to escape unbearable suffering?
You know, I don't see a policy answer to that issue, and what I really would prefer in that situation is that we need to shore up our mental health system. We need to provide good quality care for people who are suffering in terms of mental health issues. And I do not think that death with dignity is the answer, or any type of death with dignity options would be the answer in those situations.
Right, the term I used a moment ago was Dr. Kevorkian. When I was groping for was the term euthanasia, where
right,
somebody else brings about your death rather than you doing it yourself. And, of course, a lot of the claims in the early days of of the certainly in the campaign to in the run up to first passing the death with dignity law in Oregon, referred to Dr. Kevorkian and euthanasia and the whole slippery slope argument that this would become the first step toward euthanasia. Have there been any such steps that you're aware of?
No, there have been no efforts to change the definition of terminal or expand Oregon's law or offer it to a bigger set of folks. So no, there have been no opportunities to change or expand the law in 20 years in Oregon.
The fact that we're talking the six-month period, though, some of the time constraints here, and you mentioned at least 17 days at a bare minimum to go from first contact with physician to actual delivery of the medication to end the life. Is there any indication that there are some people who might not have otherwise considered this a possibility that went ahead and thought, what the heck, let's go ahead and try this? You know, acting too soon, I guess, is the question.
In our experience, again, people want to live. It's rare that there's a rush to death. In fact, I can't think of a single example where someone just wanted to hurry up and bring about their death. They really wanted to live. They did not want to have the terminal illness that they had. And so I think that people really try to wait until the very last minute, until their suffering is so great that they hasten their death.
We have an email here from Ted in Springfield. He writes, I get that you're speaking to the majority of people who probably have family members who can support and help, but please understand there are many who have no family and indeed possibly no friends either who can step in and support and help. I encourage especially those people to make sure they do an advanced directive. This form is free for people to pick up at any clinic or hospital, I believe. What does concern me is that I have read that a doctor can ignore the patient's wishes with regard to the advance directive. Please address this situation if you can and how someone can protect themselves against this if there are no family and friends around.
Well, a physician should not ignore a person's rights spelled out in advance directive. We do know that it happens occasionally and rarely, most frequently in institutions or hospital institutions that are affiliated with religion, perhaps the Catholic Church. But what would happen in that situation is that a court process would have to take place where, the court would be asked to make a decision about a person's advance directive or their living will. And so there is court recourse, but that is definitely a difficult process. But again, the idea that we should all have our wishes spelled out in a written document in an advance directive is so, so important for all of us.
Do they have to be fairly detailed to lay out a number of different scenarios? You know, if I am not breathing on my own, it's okay to take me off respirator. If my heart is not pumping by itself, it's okay to take me off whatever's keeping my heart pumping. I mean, does it have to be very specific, or can it be as simple as don't use extraordinary measures to continue my life?
You know, I believe that as specific as possible is what's important. But at the same time, if the specificity stops someone from creating one of these documents, if they get stuck because they can't decide, then I would think that less specificity is okay, too. It's whatever that needs to happen to get it written, to get them down on paper, because you can change your mind later. If your life circumstances change, if you grow older, if you have a terminal diagnosis, what you think about your end-of-life care will change. But so I think the important thing is getting it down on paper. But as you suggest, specificity is most helpful for those making decisions for you when you can't make them for yourself.
Peg, you've been at this for a long time, and you did get your doctorate as well not terribly long ago. So you've been dealing with end-of-life issues for a very long time, and it must still be hard to communicate to people that you're not talking about a culture of death. You're talking about a culture of good life here. I mean, that is the difference, isn't it?
Right. I absolutely believe that what I do at this organization and what I've built my career around is life-affirming. You know, we have so much understanding about the early parts of our lives, like when we should walk and when we should talk and when we should be able to manipulate things with our hands and learn math and learn language. And we know so little about how we die and what that process is and what we as adults, what our tasks are when we're dying, you know, to come to an understanding of the meaning of our life, to communicate with our friends and loved ones. And so what I like to think that what I'm doing, trying to do is open up life to achieve those things that we need to achieve when we're dying.
I wonder, though, when you meet people out of the blue and you get into that initial, so what do you do conversation, if when you tell people, if they have many more questions or do some of them clam up just because, you know, the American way of doing things is not to talk about death very much?
You know, in Oregon, people are just thank me for what I do, and they're so excited, and they have stories to share. But when I get outside of Oregon, it's more mixed. Some people are silent. They don't understand. So definitely in Oregon, I get a lot of support. It can be quieter if I'm talking about what I do sort of in another state.
I wonder what the use curve looks like of the Oregon Death with Dignity Law as I sit here, because, you know, there are some questions here about, obviously over 20 years since the initial passage, there have been some new developments in treatments and in pain medication and things like that that can make people at least more comfortable, if not live longer. So I wonder if there's been a steady use of the Death with Dignity Law, if it has peaked and declined, or if it's still on the way up.
It's still on the way up, but it's a very gradual decline or incline. So the first year, 24 prescriptions were written. Last year, 122 prescriptions are written. So that's a, you know, over 16 years we've increased from 24 to 122. So that's a very, very gradual incline.
And how is the outreach handled? And I mean, are doctors, I can't imagine they're required to talk about it, but it is something that they can certainly choose to present as an option. Does it usually initiate with the physician, though, or almost never?
In almost 100% of the cases, it initiates with the person, the person with a terminal illness who wants to talk to his or her physician about choices or options at the end of life.
And I noticed that there's quite a long list of religious faiths and how they match up with the Death with Dignity Law on your website. That's been quite a bit of research.
Right.
I guess we'll leave it there. Peg Sandin, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She is the executive director of the Death with Dignity National Center. Thanks so much for this comprehensive talk about the Death with Dignity laws in Oregon, Washington, and now Vermont.
Yes, thank you so much.
All right, take care. That'll do it for today's exchange. The Takeaway is coming up next on the air in the morning. Our evening rebroadcast is followed by news from the BBC. Find us online at jeffexchange.org and on Facebook. The Exchange producer is Charlotte Duren of JPR News. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us again next time and have a great day.